When men suffer from anxiety, it doesn't always look like anxiety, at least not the way we often think about it. Our next guest has advice for men on dealing with anxiety and for their friends, family members, and healthcare professionals, too. Michael Addis is a professor of psychology at Clark University in Massachusetts. He's director of the Men's Well-Being Research Group at Clark. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I think a lot of us think we know what anxiety looks like, but it sounds like, especially sometimes with men, it doesn't look that way. Can you talk about some of the things that men may experience with anxiety that we don't put in that category?
Sure. Well, you know, anxiety usually looks like fear and tension, and that's what it's designed to do. It's our body's way of telling us that there's something scary out there in the environment. But because so many of us men are taught from a young age not to express fear and not to express sadness or other types of vulnerability, when we are experiencing anxiety or depression or things like that, we often express it in ways that society finds more acceptable, like anger, like going out and binge drinking or starting a fight or doing other types of risky things as well.
Does this mean, on the whole, that anxiety might be underdiagnosed among men?
Well, it certainly means that's a possibility. You know, it's one of those things that as a researcher, it's hard to figure out because the only ways we have of diagnosing things like anxiety are by asking people questions about what they're feeling. But if so many men are under pressure that they've internalized, you know, to deny those feelings, then it's led a lot of researchers and people who work with anxiety to suspect that, yeah, we're missing a lot of cases.
When men are presented, maybe even with a diagnosis of anxiety, do they push back? Do they buy it?
Well, it depends on the guy, right? And it depends on what his beliefs are about what manhood involves and also what kinds of support he has for, you know, for taking care of himself mentally and emotionally. I mean, we've certainly found in our research that there are a number of men, and particularly those who have a sort of more traditional notion of manhood, you know, the Marlboro man and the stoicness and toughness, that do push back against the idea that they might be suffering from an anxiety disorder because I suspect they think that it implies weakness of some kind, when in fact we know it's a very common thing, and it's not your fault. It's not any sort of character weakness.
For people listening right now, I won't ask you to diagnose every listener at once right now, but what are red flags we should be watching for to say, hey, maybe I have anxiety, maybe I should pursue this to see if that is what's going on here?
Well, the first aspect of anxiety that's sort of a hallmark is a feeling of being ill at ease or worried or fearful. And it can attach itself to different things. So for like some people, it's a fear of having some sort of bodily problem, like a heart attack or a fear of dying. For other people, it's a fear of being out in wide open places. For other people, it's a fear of speaking in public or doing something else where you might get embarrassed. So if those sorts of troubles are nagging at a person, or even if it's just sort of a more general feeling of that things are going to go wrong. And the second thing is that if it starts to become such a worry that it gets in the way, you're spending an inordinate amount of time thinking about it, then, you know, it's worth at least beginning by going to your doctor and talking about it.
Talking to Michael Addis, professor of psychology at Clark University in Massachusetts, talking about anxiety and how it might look different in men sometimes in ways that we might not recognize up front as anxiety. I saw you quoted in an article talking about how to talk to men who might be in the situation for a spouse, a loved one, or maybe even a therapist. What are some ways to talk to men about anxiety that don't set up those defense signals?
It's a great question, and I think the most general thing we can do is to not get hung up on any particular words or language. So when I talk to men about anxiety, if they're telling me that their heart is pounding and that they're stressed and that they can't have trouble sleeping but they're not anxious, my first question is, well, then what would you call it? And whatever they're going to call it, that's what I'm going to call it. The other thing I would suggest is not being put off by defensiveness. You know, particularly for people who are in close relationships with men that they might be concerned about, these people may express a concern and say, hey, you know, I'm worried about you. Are you okay? And if his first response is, what are you making such a big deal about this for? Don't be put off. Come back again. Tell him that you love him. Tell him that you're concerned, because as much as men, we sometimes don't want to face the fact that we're vulnerable, we're also human beings, and we appreciate it when people express concern, and we know that they're there for us.
What's at stake here for a man, or I guess anybody, dealing with anxiety, and it's not diagnosed, it's not treated? What are the long-term consequences?
Well, it's not going to kill you. That's the good news, right? I mean, so there's no particular, it's not going to make your heart weak. It's not going to do anything physically to you. But quality of life is often compromised significantly with anxiety disorders, as well as the ability to go to work. And then in the worst case scenarios, you know, when depression starts coming on the scene, as well as anxiety, we know that men are actually 4 times more likely than women to take their own lives. So, you know, as a public health concern, our difficulties in recognizing anxiety in men and effectively treating them, it's a significant concern.
We're talking to Professor Michael Addis, director of the Clark University Men's Well-Being Research Group. We're talking about how men can experience anxiety in ways that don't always look like anxiety. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you a man dealing with anxiety? Was it hard to recognize it for what it was? Did you push back maybe on the idea that you were dealing with chronic anxiety? And have you seen this in yourself or someone you know, anxiety that maybe drives angry behavior or other outcomes that you don't usually think of as being linked to anxiety? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about how men experience anxiety. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with anxiety in your life or as someone close to you? Was it hard, especially if we're talking about a guy here, was it hard to recognize it as anxiety in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. Or if you have questions about resources to deal with anxiety, 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Mary is with us in Pewaukee. Mary, hi.
Well, hi. I'd like to add to any of the men out there that this is not a negative situation. You are brave and courageous if you admit that you have anxiety or you have emotions or if you cry. Too many times in the past, I think more in the 50s and 60s, if you grew up then, men, boys, were kind of taught to hold back their emotions. But it's brave and courageous to admit that you have anxiety or any kind of what you may feel is negative. It isn't negative. Women love men that show emotion, whether it's crying, passion, admitting you have anxiety and getting help to become a better person.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. She says maybe it was more so back in the 50s and 60s, Michael, but have we changed that much in the last, what, half a century?
Well, I think Mary's right. I mean, I think people who can express what they're feeling are always attractive to be around and you know, contribute to good relationships. I do think things are changing. I think that the messages that men are getting, particularly young boys these days, tend to be more open about emotional expression. We're seeing more professional athletes coming out about depression and anxiety disorders, and we're seeing more knowledge in the general public that are recognizing what Mary said, that there's nothing weak about this. And in addition, I think it's really important that people understand that anxiety disorders are highly treatable. So it's not a hopeless situation. There are effective counseling approaches out there and effective medications that can produce really positive results.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Charles now in Rochester, Minnesota. Charles, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Charles?
Well, just how I had dealt with anxiety over the years and how I still deal with it. I just try to put myself in a different environment in my head than what I'm at. I think more anxiety is how people will view me, you know. I guess what gives me my anxiety. I even get it at work, wanting to do like service calls, meeting new people.
Charles, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that story. So anxiety, Charles says, around the way people perceive him, and maybe people with anxiety are perceived or are worried about being seen as anxious, and there's this bad feedback loop, Michael.
Well, I think that can happen for sure. I mean, I mentioned earlier that one of the things that can make people feel anxious is concerns about embarrassing themselves or maybe assuming that other people are having negative thoughts about me in some way. And, of course, that doesn't make us feel any less stressed. It can contribute to the anxiety. And one thing I appreciated about what Charles said is he talked about coping with it by changing what mm-hmm. goes through his head. And we know that that's one of the most effective ways to deal with this is to improve our ability to talk back more rationally to anxiety, because anxiety likes to tell us stories about things going catastrophically wrong, and we've got to know what to say in that case. And typically what we want to say is something a little bit more rational and a little bit more in touch with what's actually likely to happen and not happen.
Charles, thanks a lot again for calling in. Michael, let's talk a little more about that treatment you're talking about. And people talk about sessions of cognitive behavioral therapy as a way to, as you say, tell different stories in our own heads. Can you talk about that as one of the available treatments for anxiety?
Yeah, well, the whole principle of cognitive behavioral therapy is to take anxiety from an unmanageable, unpredictable situation into something that we're well educated about and know how to handle. And so part of that is learning about how anxiety works and becoming better able to recognize our own symptoms when they're occurring, and also recognizing our own thought patterns in terms of, you know, how we can make things worse. So, for example, if my heart starts pounding and I start thinking I'm going to have a heart attack, that's clearly going to make me more anxious. But if my heart starts pounding and I start thinking, this is a symptom of anxiety, this is predictable, this is uncomfortable, I don't like it, but I'm safe, I know I'm not going to have a heart attack, then we're more likely to bring that anxiety down. And research studies have shown that this type of cognitive behavioral approach is highly effective in treating a wide range of anxiety disorders.
And briefly, as we wrap up, there are also medication alternatives, either instead of or alongside that kind of therapy you were talking about. What kind of things do doctors and therapists work with?
Well, there are a wide variety of medications, and given that we're short on time, I think what I'd say is that what you want to do is be careful about the type of medication you're taking. The medications that are short-term acting and actually sort of make us feel calm or a little bit drugged, those can be helpful in the short run, but in the long run, there is evidence that they make anxiety disorders worse, and the reason is that they do two things. They prevent us from actually confronting the things that we fear, and then they can become a sort of crutch where we come to believe that we're not going to be able to get any better and we're not going to be able to cope with the anxiety without the medication. So I would suggest that a person work with their primary care physician, try to avoid the drugs called benzodiazepines, and try to work with more of the drugs that are similar to the modern antidepressants.
Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Michael Addis, professor of psychology at Clark University. We talked to him today about anxiety and the different ways men in particular experience anxiety in ways that they might not think are anxiety. Coming up, millions of people took to the streets around the world and across Wisconsin last week to demand action on climate change. We'll look at what happened and the role that young people played in the protest. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Millions of protesters around the world took to the streets Friday to demand action on climate change. The worldwide protests were one of the biggest in history to be led by young people, with 15 rallies registered to take place here in Wisconsin. Here's 13-year-old Bryn Dixon-Croyf, who marched at one of the protests in Madison. She was carrying a sign that said, "I'll do my homework once you do yours."
It's going to be my future, and I don't get to make the decisions other people do. So if I can have any influence on that, then I can influence my future and what's going to become of me.
David Meyer is an expert on social movements and teaches sociology at the University of California, Irvine. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back, Rob.
Well, we had this global series of protests on Friday. Put it in perspective for us. How big a protest movement was this?
It was pretty massive. They estimate about 4 million people. Lots of them young people, and boy, you picked an articulate young woman to interview. So it's a really big deal, and it draws attention. The Friday climate strike was only a piece of it. There are demonstrations today across the country and in and at the UN, and Greta Thunberg's speech is going viral, and boy, is she angry. So, big deal.
This strike was led, in many cases, by young people, as you touched on there. Talk about how that fits into the history of political protests, with youth leading the way in many cases here.
Well, young people are always, not always, but are often on the front lines. They feel things more intensely. They are willing to take risks that they don't necessarily see as risks, which adults have a harder time with. So kids are ready to skip school in groups. It's hard to think about many people doing that at work. It's a harder thing to pull off a strike when people are dependent upon a paycheck. So they're willing to take risks. They're open. They also feel, many of them feel, understandably, that their government is not working for them. So we have them in school. They're learning the scientific method. They're learning about testing hypotheses from, what, sixth grade on? And the President of the United States says, trust me, because my uncle was a professor. So I'm not surprised that young people are skeptical about this. Let's add something else into that, which is that virtually everybody's got Instagram. If they don't have Instagram, they've got TikTok. If they don't have TikTok, they have three other things. And they can see Greta Thunberg sailing across the Atlantic talking every day about the urgency of climate. So there's plenty of sources of information for them, and there's been some softening up, too, in paying attention to student activism. You know, I mean, these are the same kids who went out for the March for Our Lives last year, also young people on the front lines. Well, lest I just go on too long, there's one other thing, which is that they when we see these young people speak, they're not contaminated by partisan politics. These kids are old enough to be articulate, but not so old that we're ready to dismiss them because they're partisan Democrats or disgruntled Republicans. We think that they're really seeing things as they relate to their own interests.
Is there something in particular about this issue of climate change that's going to talk to youth? Because, in effect, the way the trends are going, the younger you are, the longer you're going to experience climate change, and the more likely you are to see the worst impacts of climate change. Does that make it a particularly compelling issue for younger people?
Well, apparently, according to the Sunrise Movement and according to the people who are doing the climate strike, yes. But, you know, people have been trying to organize on climate issues for the last couple of decades and finding a hard time getting the mix of rhetoric and action together correctly so that people would turn out in the streets. Somebody, and I don't know who it was, I think a lot of people tried a lot of different things, found the right mix, which is, this is about your life. The older people can make mistakes, can drive big cars, can fly planes, can eat burgers all the time, every day, three burgers a day, and they're not going to suffer the consequences, but we are. So it's been a lot of prospecting over the past decade, but they've found a mix now that gets people out into the streets.
Talking to David Meyer, sociologist at the University of California, Irvine, looking at last Friday's global climate change strike and a, in many cases, youth-led protest movement about climate change. I want to give a listen to Greta Thunberg. You've mentioned her a couple times, the young climate activist from Sweden. This is her talking to the United Nations Climate Action Summit earlier today.
I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones.
How important is it for a movement to have a leader figure or somebody in the media who is front and center articulating this the sense of outrage?
I think if a movement doesn't put somebody forward, mass media is going to find somebody instead. And I think Greta is a great symbol. She's very passionate and powerful, but it's a mistake to think that she's the movement. The girl you spoke with, you know, the, whose interview you played, was also articulate and committed and powerful. And it's exciting in a way to listen to the intensity in Greta's voice. It's something that we expect and respect from young people that we, that makes us suspicious when older people use the same tone. So lots of people in Madison, in Irvine, in New York are surfing off Greta, but they're doing independent things. And people are doing things that Greta's never going to do. There's some kid in the science club in Madison who says, well, you know, I think what I'm going to do is steady batteries after this happens, after the climate strike. Somebody else is going to commit civil disobedience. And the climate strike events spurs the imagination of everybody who watches it, and some people are going to take actions that we don't expect.
That raises a question. How do we measure the success of a protest movement, given that it, the threads toward that success might take a long time to play out?
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm going to be a little academic now. Sorry.
That's okay.
Like one thing you do is you look at how many people participate. And recently people have been calculating this as a portion of populations. There's a really great website called Crowdsourcing where they crowdsource people who turn up at demonstrations. And this was massive. So participation is the first thing you look for. You will next look to a series of events and the diversity of events. So the climate strike was one thing, and that was definitely dramatic. But we also saw civil disobedience and direct action in Washington, D.C. and in New York. We also saw teach-ins on campuses, and that's going to matter. Next thing you look at is what media cover. And if climate is getting more coverage as a result of these strikes, which I expect is happening, though I haven't done this research yet, that's another place we look for impact. Policy and public opinion change are somewhere down the road. The other thing I'd be looking for is, what are the candidates for office talking about? If the kids are out in the street, that may lead somebody like Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar to say, hey, this is an issue that I maybe can get some traction on. I better go further with my climate plan. Maybe I'll add another paragraph into my stump speech about it. That's something else we're going to look for. And we also expect, if the movement is becoming powerful in the United States, Trump to have to respond to it. That doesn't mean he's going to do what it says, what the activists want. It doesn't mean he's going to, you know, take action that ameliorates climate change, but he's going to have to talk about what they want him to talk about, which is climate change. Even if that means, oh, it's all a conspiracy, it's a hoax by the Chinese. If he's talking about their issue, even if he's saying negative stuff or stupid stuff, that's still an indication of influence.
I want to touch on the role of social media. You brought that up a little bit earlier. I know with the Arab Spring protests, there was initial thought that, this was a Twitter protest. People spread their message on Twitter. Further analysis said, no, maybe that was just a small part of it. How has social media these days changed public protest?
Social media is a tool that gets the word out faster. So there's something called the demonstration effect of demonstrations. When you see people go out into the streets and seem to be effective, you're more likely to go out into the streets yourself. Well, back in olden times, you were dependent upon mainstream media, first newspapers, then television and radio to get those words, and it took a while. Nowadays, all the planning, all the preparation for this climate strike was readily available to young people and others across the United States and around the world long in advance. Makes it easier to generate numbers quickly. But that's almost backwards. In olden days, you built a movement from the ground up and then you had dramatic events. Now you get the dramatic events first or very early on. and you have to build the movement and the education underneath it. And that's the work that has to go on in high school clubs and college classrooms and at the workplace, people talking to their friends, music that comes out on YouTube. All of this stuff is percolating. And the demonstrations are the easiest thing to focus on. And it's not that they're not important, but the real work takes place in between the dramatic demonstrations.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's David Meyer, professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. He was with us today to talk about young people and their role in social movements after youth-led climate change protests last Friday that drew millions of people around the world. Coming up, we'll talk to two Milwaukee natives about how to combat extremism and how to keep young people from falling prey to radicalization.